Thank you very much, Rabbi Dr. Shabtai, for coming to Contemporary Halacha 2015 to talk about brain death, which is what you have researched and worked on extensively in your Sefer Defining the Moment, available somewhere. Available at the farm sale and elsewhere. So, b'chavad Rabbi Shabtai.
I want to thank Rabbi Orly, and again, I love, I very much enjoy talking about this topic. I have this fascination with morbid topics, with death. I teach and speak about it a little bit too easily, so if it's not comfortable for you or whatever, I understand that. So if you want to ask questions during this year or afterwards, it's a hard thing for some people to think about. I talk about it all the time at my Shabbos table, with my kids, with my wife. It's kind of strange. We had a meal with an estate planning lawyer, so he was like used to doing that, but his wife was like, oh, there's some other weirdo like that. So we're not we'll talk about the defining moment of death and what that means, and we're not going to discuss any of the emotional aspects of it or anything like that, and we're going to do it with the explicit knowledge ahead of time that we're not doing so. Not because they're not important, not because they don't exist, they do, and when you're dealing with this in real life, often those are the more difficult issues you have to deal with. We're not ignoring them, we're just putting them on the side and saying we're only dealing with a specific subset of the issues, which is specifically, halakhically, how are we going to define the moment of death, recognizing that there's a lot more that goes on during that time that we are going to not be discussing at all. So, I have three goals for this year. The first is to understand the relevant questions. What are the questions that we're supposed to be asking when it comes to the understanding the moment of death? The second is to develop three basic approaches that I think are found in the modern-day poskim, and then, depending on how much time we have and how it goes, trying to delve into some of the different shitas. I try to do something different each year. So I think this year we'll try to do a Shlomo Zalman Auerbach shita. Happy to discuss any of the other ones, but just to change it up a little bit. I know you haven't heard it, but the others have, and so it's just more interesting for me to change it. And so I am not planning on paskening anything. I wrote a whole book about this. I swear explicitly I'm not paskening anything. I've gotten criticisms from both ends of the spectrum that you're paskening the other way. So I'm telling you fairness, I didn't mean to pasken anything. I'm not a posek. We're talking about life and death issues. And when you're talking about life and death issues, you need to talk to a posek who's a gadol. Like we're talking about, this is serious stuff. I'm not going to pretend to pasken any shilas. I'm not going to do that. We'll present. We have posken who we can present. Rabbi Moshe, Shlomo Zalman. And we'll talk about poskim, who they're going to poskim. I'm just presenting their opinions. The only thing I will disagree with is one thing the Rabbanut once said. The Rabbanut in 1987, I think it's Tavshin and Ches, but I think it was 1987, wrote a whole letter advocating their position about brain death. We're not really going to go into it too much, but at the beginning, they have a line where they say, "En kan sheila hilchatit mesubechet." It's not a very complicated halachic shayla. So I'm going to explicitly disagree with that. And that's going to be the end of my explicit disagreement. I do think it's a little bit complicated, and given that other poskim think it's complicated, I think I'm in good standing. But I do think it's complicated, and I will disagree with that one sentence. And then just one other thing just one note of, I was in yeshiva for the past couple of years, and now I've been out for a couple of months, and just as someone who's left for a little bit and has the opportunity to come back every so often, just, we have the most amazing Rosh Yeshiva ever. You should just realize that, and so much of what I learned about this topic was because Arash Yeshiva, all of them, Bli Yotzei Min HaKlal, even if they give off the impression they're not, are comfortable with you saying, really, I don't understand that because there's a Gemara here. They'll say something and they're comfortable with, in a mechubadik way, not saying, you know, you're wrong, but there are ways to question the Arash Yeshiva, and so much of the way I understand things is because I didn't understand him the first time. Not that he was wrong the first time, Chas v'Chalila, but because of the give and take that I think we have here that in some places doesn't exist. It's something to take advantage of, and all the rest of it here strongly encourage it, even when they don't seem to. And it's something that's a unique opportunity, I think, that I want to just mention briefly. Okay, so I'm not going to go through why we care if a person is dead or not, because Alpidin, you probably understand, Avelos, Tomas Kohanim, all sorts of things happen. Scientifically, we're going to wonder why do I care specifically the very, 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 very moment that a person is dead from the scientific perspective, and we're going to do a little bit of science first. I don't know, Torah, we're going to do the Mada first, and then Torah, so we can inform the so we can make an educated Torah opinions. Why do I care is because of two things that mostly came up. Is first of all, when can I stop treating somebody? I have a limited number of resources, I have a limited number of machines, I have a limited number of staff. If a person is dead, I'm not going to treat them. If they are alive, I may choose to continue treating them. When can I or must I stop? The second issue is one of organ donation. We have something in this country known as the dead donor rule. It has a cognitive halachal munch in a moment, that if I want to have an organ transplant, if I want to take an organ from a donor to give to a recipient, I may not remove a life-sustaining organ from anybody if by doing so I will end their life. So a heart is a life-sustaining organ, and I may not remove it from somebody if by removing it from that donor I will have ended his life, and save somebody else. In other words, you can't kill one person to save another. It's Yaharik Valyavar. We have a cognate in halacha. It's very clear. You can't kill one person to save another, and therefore have to make sure that the donor is dead before I take that heart and give it to somebody else. Because if he's alive, and when I removed his heart, I've killed him, and I've killed one person to save another, and that is both illegal and usur. Not necessarily in that order of importance. So the question is, fine, we need to determine, well, and just as a caveat, I know this isn't the topic, but in terms of just organ donations, last time I looked it up, it was a couple of months ago, I apologize, there are about 115,000 people in this country waiting for organ transplants. That's a lot of people. Over 90,000 of them are waiting for kidneys. Kidneys, every person is born with two. Every healthy person can donate a kidney while you're alive and live a very long life. Thereafter, statistically speaking, this used to be true, I think it's still true, even if it's not, it's a good story at least, that kidney donors on average live longer than the average American, or that's what we used to believe. And so the question is why? So I think then you can do both Torah and Mada. From the Torah perspective, why? Because you did something that was phenomenal. You did pikuach nefesh, you saved somebody's life by giving of yourself in the most intimate way possible. You gave one of your kidneys to save someone else's life, and you have a shkacha pratis, and a shkacha broker takes care of you. And on average, statistically speaking, those people will live longer. Together with that, if you are eligible to be a kidney donor, you're probably healthier to begin with than the average American, and you would have lived longer anyway. Regardless, kidneys are something you can give mechayim, completely separate shear, but again, over 90,000 of those 115 or so thousand are waiting for kidneys, which is not what we're talking about. Hearts and lungs and livers, depending on livers, we're not going to talk about it so much, hearts and lungs, there are about 3,000 and change people waiting for hearts out of that 115,000. So how do you know a person is dead? Because that's the critical question I need to know. I can want to take this person's heart out. I want to have a transplant. I have a patient who their heart has failed in such a significant way that I have no therapy for them. I have nothing I can do for them. The heart is failing. It hasn't necessarily stopped. It's failing. And the only therapy that we know of today is to replace it. Now, we've tried to replace it with plastic. We've tried to replace it with metal. It hasn't been terribly successful. Mirch Hashem, that should be a more successful way to do it, because once we can do that, you can manufacture these and have them, and you don't have to deal with any of these shilas. And the issue isn't just avoiding these shilas, we'll discuss brain death, it's not all that common. And so even if brain death is death, and if every brain dead person donated hearts, it would certainly increase the number of people who would receive it. The question is, would we even then have enough organs to help all the people who are waiting? Or if we can come up with some artificial organ, that would be better. So nothing that we've done so far artificially is helpful. You need to replace it with another human heart. So where do you get a human heart? From another human. And we get to the question of, is that human the donor? Is he alive or dead? Because if he's alive, I may not take it both legally and halachically. So the question is, you walk into an intensive care unit, you have a bunch of patients who look like they're dying. You walk into the intensive care unit and everybody looks pretty much the same. They're connected to a bunch of tubes, to a bunch of machines. Everything's beeping, everybody's yelling, everybody's screaming. How do you know if they're alive or dead? What are you looking for? When you look at these patients, how do you know if they're alive or dead? You have to look for something. So what are you looking for? You might want to look if they have a heartbeat on their monitor. You might want to look if their people are on a ventilator, ventilator is helping them breathe, is showing that oxygen is going in and out. You might want to talk to them. If they can talk to you, that might be a symbol, that might be a sign that a person is indeed alive. Rather, they might be moving, they might be talking, they might be interacting with you, they might be responding to pain. All of these things are things you can do to see if a person is alive or dead. But what are you really doing? What are you testing? When you poke someone's foot with a needle, what are you really testing? You're testing to see if they have a pain response. When you're talking to someone, so you want to see if they have conscious thought, or at least the ability to respond to you in a coherent way. You can ask someone to squeeze your fingers, which is also a way to respond. A person can't speak but can still squeeze your fingers, that means a lot's going on. It means that if they can do that on command, it means first of all they're hearing the information, secondly they're processing that information, and then they're able to take that information and transmit it into an actual motor function. It means a lot's going on. So what you're doing is, when you're doing any of these tests that you're doing, you're looking for some physiological parameter, something that's happening in the body that is a criteria that I'm looking for. Is there a pain response? When I poke the needle into the foot, I'm not looking to see that the needle hits the foot. I know that the needle hits the foot. I'm looking to see if there's a pain response that the person pulls his foot back. If I'm looking to see if there's an EKG monitor, I'm not looking to see that there's a line on the screen. I know that there's a line on the screen. The line on the screen represents the fact, a criteria I'm looking for is their heart function. And we assume that EKG monitor represents heart function. You don't have to know what an EKG is. You just know the sign that says beep, 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 beep. Right? So we're looking, those are tests that we do to determine a criteria. I'm belaboring the point for a very particular reason. Right? It seems a little bit obvious. We have tests, and those tests are, well, is this true or not? Does this person have a heart rhythm or not? The question is yes or no. So I do a test, I find out if he has a heart rhythm or not. Then, because I'm looking for inherently the heart rhythm. But okay, so I have all these tests to determine different things. I have a test to determine if he has a heart rhythm. I can do a test to determine if the person is able to breathe on his own. It's more complicated. I have a test to determine if the person is able to speak to me. I can talk to him. I have a test to determine if they have a pain reflex. So which one or ones of them are going to be important? How am I going to choose among these different things what is going to make this person alive? How am I going to determine? So he has a pain reflex, but he doesn't have a heart rhythm. So let's assume everyone has a heart rhythm, because otherwise we're going to assume someone doesn't have a heartbeat, so they're going to be dead according to Kulei Alma. We'll see why. But person's able to breathe, but he has no pain reflex. So is he alive or dead? Person's not able to speak, not able to respond. There's no response at all, but they're able to breathe on their own. So are they alive or dead? How are you going to determine that? What kind of doctor would you ask to see if they're alive or dead? Anyone? No? Not raising your hand. Okay, yeah.
Would this answer not be more clarified if we had a basic definition of how does halacha view someone as being dead or not?
Absolutely, 100%. So that's my point. The question is, well, if I say, well, you know what, the person's dead when they stop breathing. I'll say, why? So you'll ask a doctor, and the doctor will tell you, well, the patient's dead because he's not able to breathe on his own, let's say. So, well, why is that so? Well, he's not able to breathe on his own, he can't take oxygen, he can't oxygenate blood, he can't oxygenate the blood, he can't provide energy to all the cells. Okay, so why is that important? Well, you need to provide energy for the cells in order to function. Why is that definition of life? Because cellular energy is required to maintain life. Okay, but why is that the most important thing? At some point, you can't answer with yes or no. You can't answer with a number. You can't answer with math. You have to answer with, well, this is important because I have a particular value, I have a particular view of what it means to be alive, what it means to be dead. I have a particular notion of what that means. I have a concept of death, a definition of life and death, which is really a philosophical idea. It's something much, much deeper. A person is alive, it's a person who's able to interact with the environment. Let's just say, for example, mehechitesi. So, because I understand that makes me different from a plant. I'm different from a plant on the fundamental way because I interact differently with the environment. Plants interact with the environment too. But I interact differently with the environment than the plant does. A person might say, well, just examples, this is not necessarily in halacha, a person is only alive when he's able to interact with another human being on the human level. Right? What differentiates us from animals? Maybe that we're able to be a full person. If a person is completely incapable of conscious thought anymore, maybe I would consider them to be dead. Now, why is that scientifically true? Well, I can't give you a scientific formula that tells you why it's true. There's no yes or no. There's no math formula that will tell you that the inability to have conscious thought is death. No, it's an idea, and I'm not advocating that position. I'm just saying an example for whatever parameter you're going to choose. It's a concept. It's an idea. It's a philosophical notion, an ethical, a value principle. And for us, that's a halachic notion. And so it's not a medical question at all. When is a person dead, meaning what defines definition of death, is not a medical question at all. Medicine is a science. It can say yes or no. It can give numbers to answers. You can ask the doctor, what are the person's chances of survival? They can give you a percentage. You can say, well, how likely is it that this person will ever be able to breathe again? You can say zero. So is that person alive or dead? Well, all he can do is give you a fact. Death is not a fact. It's a status. And therefore, it has to be based on a definition of death. So we have a definition of death, which is a concept. And once I have that concept, that definition, the philosophical notion or ethical notion, in this country we have a legal notion because we assume that the law is supposed to at least represent those values of the tzibur. On the federal, state, local level, whatever it is, the law is supposed to represent the values of the tzibur that elected those officials. And therefore, we assume that the legal definition of death represents our values of what it means to be alive or dead. It may or may not. We might change that. The law can change. But the law as it is, therefore, in this country, it's a legal definition. It's not a medical definition. It's a legal definition that what death is, because that represents a certain value judgment. So we have a definition of death, which can be this vague concept, which we might call Yetzias Neshama. What is that? But whatever it is, we understand that there's a Neshama. Yetzias Neshama might be the definition of death. But what is that? What are the physiological criteria that correspond to that? So I'll have to find some physiological criteria that correspond to Yetzias Neshama. We have to figure out how to do that. And indeed, that's what Chazal are going to talk about. We're not going to talk about when's Neshama there, when's not Neshama there. We don't really know. We're going to deal with things that we can see. What are those criteria? But they reflect something deeper. And then, if you want to know how those things... Well, let's say it's breathing. Well, how do you know if a patient's breathing or not? You have to go to the doctor and say, doctor, tell me, is this patient breathing or not? So you can go and do a test to see if a patient is breathing or not. Belaboring the point, because it's very important. And interestingly, in this country... Yeah.
But has there been a conflict between what halacha would say death is medical understanding?
Oh yeah. Oh, we'll get there in a second. But maybe not a second. That's a lie. We'll get there eventually. But in this country, so it's the discussion of the definition of death has pretty much been run by a bunch of doctors. Since 1968, there was an ad hoc at the Harvard Medical School, there was an ad hoc committee for the determination of brain death, which a bunch of doctors got together and determined that brain death, which we'll discuss in a moment, is indeed death. And it was advocated by a bunch of doctors. And for many, many years, this was accepted as, who determines this? This is a medical definition. A bunch of doctors are running the agenda. They're going to tell us who death is. And the lawyers pretty much ceded the ability to the doctors to do that. And that's pretty much how the discourse goes. But if you think about it, and most medical ethicists today recognize the fact, that it's not a medical decision at all. Doctors have an important role to play, first of all, because they can explain to you the physiology better than, let's say, some philosopher, right? So the criteria, what criteria represents your definition, you might want to ask a doctor, a physiologist, or a scientist. But what your definition is, the doctor doesn't necessarily have any more insight to it than you do, right? What the definition of life and death is a notion, a philosophical notion, a halakhic notion, an ethical notion, is not, it's a values judgment. It's not necessarily that a doctor has any more insight into that than a regular Sama person. And therefore, that's an important question to think about. And indeed, that was a little bit difficult to overcome. It's a little bit difficult to overcome, and people need to recognize that. And while it might be obvious that the people who learn Gemara all day, that, you have to think about the question, what type of question we're asking, this is a not very obvious point at all. And many times someone will say, well, why don't you just ask the doctor? Why does halacha have its own definition? Shouldn't we just have a medical definition of what death is and just go with that? Why in the world should halacha have any say here whatsoever? We're talking about medicine and science. You know, we don't, when there are two options. Do you do, for some type of treatment, do you do chemo or do you do surgery? Well, there are statistics that determine each one, what's more likely, and then you have options to do them. You're not going to go and say, well, what does Hanar say about it? It's not. This is a medical question. What gives you the better odds? What gives you the better facts? And you can determine that, assuming that both are halakhically permissible. But this is not a question of facts or numbers. It's a question of value judgments when you get down to it. And therefore, yes, halakha has a lot to say about it, just like every value system has a lot to say about it. Although, in the moment, it looks like a medical decision, because I need to know, are these criteria being met? Are the tests reflecting the criteria? I need a doctor to do it for me. So practically, yes, the doctors determine death because they're necessary to find out, have those criteria been met. But fundamentally, the definition of death is not a medical question at all, and therefore it's very important that halacha has something to say about it, and although it might be obvious, it's not necessarily obvious, and it's an important point to point out.
To go back on, you just mentioned that how, like, for example, wanted to do chemo or something, you wouldn't consult, like, rabbinic court, is that a halacha question?
I said assuming that both are permissible.
Okay, so why?
I mean, which is better?
So why would death be any different? Like, it's a value, like Judaism values life and death, but why should you consider a post-sex about what death is?
Because death fundamentally is a flaw. What do we assume is life and death? What is that definition? It's a question of values. You can't ask a doctor, you're not going to ask a mathematician, what is the value of the life, how do I determine life from death, right? Because it's not a math function. The same thing with medicine, it's just a more advanced type of a science. It's advanced in the terms of specific and applying it. There is no yes or no. Well, the person has no blood pressure, so is he alive or dead? That's all the doctor can tell you. His blood pressure is zero. His heart is not beating. Fact. Okay. That's a fact. Was he alive or dead? That's a judgment. That's a value judgment call. It's not yes or no. Yes, his heart's not beating. We agree. That's a fact. Now, what do you do with that information? What value do you assign to each of those values is going to be a question that is halachic. So, yes, often in making treatment determinations, well, what are the risks? Assuming that they're both halachically permissible, which is better for you? I don't know. That's what's better for you. That's going to be a decision on your own. This is going to be more of a fundamental issue. And so the reason that, again, this is so very important, so fine, so, okay, so you're thinking, okay, so we need to take hearts from dead people, so take hearts from dead people. So wait till they're dead and take their hearts and give them to somebody else. And Shalom al-Yisrael, what am I sitting here giving a shiur about it? There are plenty of people who die every single day. Plenty of people die every day. If we took hearts from all the people who died every day, we would certainly have more than the supply to then 115,000 people. I mean, I don't know how many people die in this country every year. Certainly more than 115,000 people. And therefore, why not just take all of their organs and transplant them to those who need it, and so on, Israel, and there's no shaila at all. Yes, there's a question of nivel ha'meis. It needs to be addressed. It only needs to be addressed. There's nivel ha'meis. If the person's dead, I'm taking out his heart. It's nivel ha'meis. It's terrible. We should bury someone whole. We know we're very makbid to bury someone whole. We have zaka going all around. You know, Rahman al-Hassan after terrorist attacks, trying to pick up all the pieces and bury them. Okay, all that's true. But we're talking about the Goh Mevesh. So, yes, there's an asay, kabar tikavarenu, and there's a law, lo shalom livlaso, all that's true, but b'makom pikuach nefesh, we're going to violate all those laws, just like I would drive on Shabbos to do that. So, yes, in the Chanami, there's nivel ha'meis, but the issue is pikuach nefesh, and therefore it's the shaila falls. The question is, what if it's not, so hearts, kidneys, lungs, livers, they're all pikuach nefesh. What about things that aren't pikuach nefesh, not the topic for today? What about, let's say, a cornea transplant, the person is blind, you have to take a cornea, meaning the outer covering of the eye. You can take it from a mace and give it to a person. So there's technically no pikuach nefesh involved unless you say iver chasuf kameis, suma chasuf kameis. You can come up there a lot of tshuvas about this. Not our issue right now. We're talking about only about pikuach nefesh, and therefore in a chanami there's nivel ha'meis. But organ donation from a halachic perspective, just off the bat, without any relation to the question of determining the moment of death, is certainly permissible. According to almost all the poskim, there is an opinion of the Binyan Siyan, who would probably assert it, and I can get into that right now, but that's been summarily rejected by almost all of the poskim. Just be aware that this is a big obstacle in the Stam, the perspective out there. Many people assume that working donation is usur because of Nevel HaMeis, or because of something having to do with Chiyas HaMeisim. I get the question at least once a week, once every 2 weeks. What about Chiyas HaMeisim? How is HaKadosh Baruch Hu going to Mechay HaMeisim if I gave my organ after Misa to somebody else? I said that's not my problem, that's his. If we're allowed to do it, so then there's likely a mitzvah to do it, so I'm doing what God wants, so he'll figure it out. Secondly, after about a couple of months, the body's decomposed anyway, so if he could do that, then I don't see what the big deal is too. I'm not limiting HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power to Chiyas HaMeisim. We don't do something befeirish to, you know, they say cremation is showing a lack of belief in Chiyas HaMeisim because you're showing he can't do it. I don't think this is at all. I think this is you're the person who's donating is clearly dead, so the Meisim Chafshi, but someone's doing a mitzvah here, and therefore I don't think it could be, that's not an issue. But you should be aware, this is a very, very, very common thought among a lot of people. Could a guy do Nevel HaMeis? We will assume yes, because ultimately it'll be Bikuch Nefesh for a Jew.
You can't do Bikuch Nefesh for a Goy and Shabbat.
We assume you can. Lamaisa, we assume yes. Lamaisa, we assume it is Mishum Bikuch Nefesh. We'll get it, we can discuss it. Lamaisa, we assume it is Mamish Mishum Bikuch Nefesh. Not Mishum Eva, but Mamish Bikuch Nefesh. There's two of them. I don't want to get off track, and I'm happy to talk about it with you better after. Maybe I'll. We'll talk about it later. Fine. Moving on. In terms of the sign, so why don't I just do this? Why don't I take hearts from dead people? Because they don't work. Person's dead. His heart stopped working. What makes you think that if I take the heart of a dead guy and I put it into a living person, that heart is all of a sudden going to start working? The heart stopped working. That's why this guy maybe, or one of the symptoms that this guy is dead. So his heart's not working. So how am I ever going to take a heart from a dead person and give it to a living person and assume that heart's going to work? Now, if you could say, you know, you can do the shock and the clear and you can electroshock the person, so why not do it to the maze? The person who you think is dead. Right, this guy who has a heart right now, if you could shock him, it would come back, so then do so. Don't give it to somebody else. Now, we're going to assume now, for the entire discussion, that any time I talk about any definition or criteria or a test for death, we're always going to assume that if I do or do not say the word, that it's there, the term irreversible. Every definition of death or criteria for death in halacha must be irreversible. It must be the irreversible cessation of, I don't care what it is, but it must be irreversible. We do not have the power of Chiyas HaMeisim, it's a Gemara Tanya space, we don't have the power of Chiyas HaMeisim. And therefore, if a person dies and comes back, it turns out they were never dead. Why? Because whatever criteria you determined they were dead by, it wasn't irreversible. The haraya, it was reversed. And so that's the enlecha proof gadol mizeh, that the person is reversible. Now, whatever criteria, let's say heartbeat, right? Let's use the criteria of heartbeat. When the heart stops, we'll assume for the sake of argument that that's the assumption we're going to go with, that a person is dead. So when the person's heart stops, are they dead or not? It just stopped a moment ago. I have no idea. Is it going to come back or not? I may not know right now. It may be irreversibly stopped. It may not be. I'm mistaken because I'm limited in my knowledge. That doesn't mean that the etzim, it's reversible or not. Meaning it might take 2-3 minutes for it to become irreversible. And if I do CPR right now, I may or may not be able to save him. But at some point, it's going to be irreversible, and we're going to assume for the sake of argument that every definition of death is going to require that something to be irreversible. Otherwise, the person comes back. You know, we breathe approximately 12 times a minute. So 12 times a minute, you're dead. That's ridiculous, because I'm going to take another breath. But I'm not breathing right now. Okay, but it's not right. I didn't stop breathing irreversibly. I just stopped breathing voluntarily. I'm going to breathe again. And it's a shame. So we're assuming the definition of death is always going to be something that's irreversible. If a person dies and comes back, it means they were never dead. It could turn out that the shaila then is, it's a fascinating shaila, what if someone's heart stops, and then you work on them for 20 minutes, and then they die, and then you can't get it back? So when did they die? So Shlomo Zalman has such a shaila. Let's say they're from Breuers, and only one person says Kaddish, and the 20 minutes stands Shkia. So is his yurtzeit the first day, the second day? Who gets to say Kaddish? So it's a very, 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 you know. Kaddish is an important thing to do. You can always go down the block where everyone says Kaddish. But the question is, you could come down to fundamentally, did the person die when I stopped trying? And so that becomes interesting. But we're going to assume for the sake of argument that everything is irreversible, otherwise there's nothing to talk about. So the question is, fine, so where am I going to get this dead person whose heart is going to be useful for me? What I need is a heart-beating cadaver. I need a dead person with a heartbeat. So could such a thing exist or not? Right, ideally, that's what I want. I want a heart that works, so it needs to be beating, and I need the person to be dead, so I don't. When I take a heart out, I don't kill him.
You can't have a heart that, I don't know anything about the size, but you can't have a heart that works within the context of a live person. Just because the heart, like, it might need the rest of the system to be working.
So if you assume that the heartbeat is one of the criteria for life or death, so then no, then you're up the creek, right? Because if the assumption is that the heart is working, the person's alive. If you have that assumption, then you're never going to get off the ground, correct? I mean, because the person who has the heartbeat, so it's working.
The heart can't be here, it could be here.
In theory.
Right now, if his heart's beating, and you said that's alive.
No, no, but he's saying, let's say have a situation, in this person, the Chai Gav makes not, but in another,
right,
potentially, it could, in theory. I think it could. So the question is, we want to find something more common. Where are we going to find the heart beating cadaver? In 1968, the Harvard committee at Harvard Medical School came up with the notion of brain death. Brain death meant that a person has such neurological devastation, their brain is so completely damaged that they are no longer considered to be alive, even if the rest of their body is working. So brain death is the end of a physiological process, usually as a result of trauma or some other neurological devastation, where a person's brain first swells and the brain largely stops functioning.
It's possible that the heart is still beating?
The heart is still beating, otherwise we have nothing to talk about. Now, this has to happen in an intensive care unit, because otherwise, so let's talk about it just briefly. There's the outer part of the brain controls like thought and motion and stuff like that, very, very broadly speaking, not scientifically. The lower parts control more of the vegetative functions, those things we don't think about. Okay, like balance, blood pressure, temperature, things like that, as well as breathing. Breathing is something we don't think about, it happens naturally. We can override it voluntarily, right? I can hold my breath, but at some point, Professor Baruch created a system where if I hold my breath long enough, I'm stupid enough that I pass out. The reason that I pass out is because my body says, well, you're being a fool. This isn't a smart thing for you. So I'm going to stop you from being able to stand. I'm going to knock you down, knock out your conscious thoughts so you can continue breathing again. It makes sense.
Is this only relevant for like heart donation, meaning if the heart stops beating, is it still possible to take other vital organs?
But sometimes, depending on the context. Yes and no. We'll talk about it in a moment. For most organs, we want them to be... So what does the heart do? We'll get to the... Let me pause for a moment. Let me define what brain death is, and then we'll get to what the heart and lungs do, and then we'll get to why the organs are important. So brain death was defined as having the following three criteria medically. They've been amended a little bit here and there. Broadly speaking, it means that a person is irreversibly unconscious. They will never wake up again. How you make that determination, again, has to be irreversible. Consult your local neurologist. They will tell you the person is irreversibly unconscious. Now, the bottom of the brain is called the brain stem. Makes sense? The brain has like a thinner part at the bottom. It controls breathing and other vegetative functions. Brain death requires that the brain stem largely no longer functions. So, but I have to give you a criteria. That doesn't mean anything. It's an anatomical definition. So a person's irreversibly unconscious. There are certain reflexes that are modulated by the brain stem. The person has no brain stem reflexes, not like hitting your knee and you kick out, but the gag reflex that if something shoves down your throat, you choke. Ocular reflex, someone pokes your eye, so you close your eye. All sorts of other reflexes that are controlled by your brain stem, that the brain stem no longer has brain stem reflexes, and a person is no longer able to breathe on their own. They are incapable of having any spontaneous respiration. Spontaneous means it comes from oneself. Now, some people can have some amount of respiration, but not a complete amount. And therefore, we'll put them on a ventilator. A ventilator is a machine that helps you breathe. Not everybody in the ventilator is unable to breathe on their own. So you might see a patient in the ventilator, or you might know people in the ventilator who are able to breathe and who are not brain dead according to any definition, but they're not able to breathe completely on their own. This is providing them with assistance. For a person to be brain dead, they cannot breathe on their own at all. They have zero spontaneous respiration, and the ventilator is doing everything for them.
Did you say that can someone still not be brain dead, but their heart can stop functioning, but they can still... It's reversible, like you could be brought back to life, correct?
Yeah, let's say a person has a heart attack, their heart stops, we could do CPR in theory and bring them back to life. Doesn't always work.
Technically, they wouldn't be considered medically
dead at that point. So, Shaila, I don't understand the legal aspects of it. Are you dead, then you come back alive, or do you say, I'm afraid the person was never dead? I don't know, legally speaking, what that means. Halachically, I think it's very clear. The person was never metame ba'ol. That's clear. The person was never metame ba'ol. There's a tshuva in the Atari Paz, Rav Pinchas Vichy. He has a whole long tshuva. Why is this person's wife? What if he's a kayin? Can he remet? A whole thing, it was tummy, does he have to remarry her? Is she now, do you have to get remarried or not? The answer is no. So he tries to prove very lumdish, very long thing that the Misas Abal is only mafkia, the kid is only matia, the whole thing, only when he's mikvur, he has a whole bunch of things. I think the simple answer is he was never dead, and therefore there was never Misas Abal, and therefore the question never gets off the ground. I, his heart stopped, he may have been dead. Okay, but it turns out he wasn't. But he has a very long tshuva about this to try to argue without admitting this point that it's not true. As long as you don't bury someone in the ground, the assumption is that they're still married, according to his not our issue, but I think that the person wouldn't, halakhically speaking, the person's not dead. Legally speaking, I don't think they I think the same structure should work. I don't think anyone requires them to get remarried. It's a little more Belchanan and Eliyahu and Navi's wife, and fine, for another time. or Zera's wife from Purim. Purim could Purim cover on that. Fine.
Halacha would be that if someone's heart were to stop, after what time period would you consider the person dead?
When it's irreversible. When is that? I don't know. I have to ask a doctor. That meaning that's the criteria. The criteria is irreversible. So what test do you do? I don't know. The test is a fact. Is a question? Yes or no? Fact? Yes or no? Do we that can change. The test can change every single day. We may have more advanced technology that can determine the criteria better. The criteria stands. The test may change. So why is brain death? Why is this person? They consider a person to be dead because their brain is so devastated. This person can no longer think, can no longer have conscious thought. The point of the brainstem being out means not that the focus is on the brainstem per se, but if the brainstem is out, it means the whole brain has already stopped working. Largely, not completely so, but mostly so, and they determined that that was enough to consider a person dead. So why is their heart still beating? So now these people have to be on the ventilator because they can no longer breathe on their own. They have to be provided oxygen. So long as you are provided oxygen, your heart will continue beating for the following reason. So the reason you take a breath is because your brain initiates a signal to a bunch of nerves, to your diaphragm, the tarfish, and chulin, we don't learn tarfish anymore, to the tarfish, to the diaphragm, which expands and contracts, and can therefore help you breathe by changing the pressures back and forth around your lungs. And you suck in air. So now if your brainstem is not functioning, you don't send that signal. If you don't send that signal, the muscles don't contract, they don't expand, and therefore a person cannot breathe on their own. Now a heartbeat does not require any input whatsoever from the brain in order to beat. It doesn't require the brain to initiate a beat at all. Now the brain can slow down or speed up a beat, right? We know that when you start running, for example, your heart will beat faster because your brain is telling you, beat faster, we're running now. When you're slowing down, your brain will tell your heart, slow down. There's a neurological input to that, there's an endocrine system to that, right? There's adrenaline that will also help these things come in. So for example, you know, heart transplants do happen in this country. So there, you do not need, again, your brain to initiate a beat. So a person who has a heart transplant gets a heart from a donor, right? And that heart is transplanted now into the recipient. There is no neurological hookup to this man's brain. The heart is not connected to this man's brain, right? We didn't do that. We just put it in and connected all the pipes, and it's working on its own. It's beating on its own. So when this person wants to start running, his heart doesn't necessarily start speeding up enough. He has to wait till the endocrine system kicks in to do that, because there is no connection between his brain and the heart. And it's not necessary in order to have a beat. So even though the brain can be largely dysfunctional, the heart can continue to beat all on its own. Other areas of the body can continue to be on their own, can continue to function on their own as well. The liver, the pancreas, the intestines all continue to function on their own. A woman can be pregnant and gestate a baby, and that baby can continue to grow all on its own as long as this person is being provided with oxygen, which they can't breathe anymore, and some type of a nutrition so they can maintain energy. And so the question now is, we have such a patient. So the patient is now, we're assuming their brain is no longer functioning, their brainstem is out, they cannot breathe on their own, but their heart and other areas of their body are beating. Is such a person going to be alive or dead? If the person is alive because their heart is beating, other parts of their body are still working, then a brain-dead person is considered to be alive, and taking their organs would be forbidden. And if a person is considered to be dead because he can no longer breathe on his own, then this person is dead, and therefore we should be allowed to take his organs because he is dead, and even though it violates the problem of nivel hames. So let's leave all the... I think that's enough for the science. Is the science clear? You don't need all of it to have every detail, but yeah. Potentially so. Meaning, if their heart's continuing to beat, why is their heart beating? Is their heart beating spontaneously or not spontaneously? Meaning, so at some point you're going to have to say, well, that's what is the gather of spontaneous. You have to know what is you're doing it. Meaning, if I do cardiac massage right on the person's heart and squeeze it like this, so it's not beating. Meaning, if I want to talk about circulation, that circulation is a symptom of life or is a criteria for death, and so I can take a freshly dead corpse and take the body and tilt it like this, back and forth like this, and the blood will continue circulating in this person's body. That's not circulation. That's completely artificial. And therefore, that's nothing. So at one point, you'll have to say, well, when is enough enough? You'll have to find together, and I admittedly don't know that I have one.
So without help, the heart can't go on
pray. No. Okay. So let's see what the Makaras have to say. So as Dr. Avram Steinberg points out, there is no real good discussion of death in Halacha. In the Gemara, we don't have an accurate definition anywhere because it was very obvious. This only exists now. The whole idea of brain death only exists because I have a ventilator. But otherwise, a person's heart stopped beating and stopped breathing within moments of each other because without oxygen, you can't have a heartbeat. And without a heartbeat, you can't breathe. Right? The only reason that I can do any of this now is because I can put the patient on the ventilator and artificially supply the oxygen. I can keep the heart going even though the patient can't breathe. That's a chiddush. And because that's a chiddush, it only existed since like the 60s. And this is not something that ever happened before. So let's see the Gemara. The Gemara is based on the Mishnah, and Yuma Pei Gimel Amud Aleph. So, Misha Nafla till the end of the Mishnah, Misha Nafla of Amapola, Safik Lusham, Safik Enosham. So a person is under an avalanche or a building collapse, and we don't know if he's there, we don't know if he's not there, Safik Chai, Safik Mace, we don't know if he's alive or dead, Safik Kusi, Safik Yisrael, Mefakhin Lava Tagal. It doesn't make a difference, we are Mefakeh Lava Tagal. We want to make sure we will violate whatever the Isser of Mefakhin Lava Tagal. We're not going to get into that right now, we're going to assume it's Isser Daraisa involved. Talking about it on Yom Kippur here, or on Shabbos, we violate Shabbos to save someone, even if we don't know if he's there, we think he might be there, even if we don't know he's alive or dead, right? Because there's a chance he might still be alive. The Mishnah continues, Mitzau Chai Mefakhin. If you find that he's alive, then you continue. Ve'imeis Yanichuhu. But if you find out that the person is dead, you have to stop. You have to stop doing the Pikuach Hagal, because the mace is, first of all, Muktzah, you're not doing Ruach Nefesh anymore, there's no Heter to continue in whatever Malacha you're doing, and therefore wait until after Shabbos, and you can proceed with the funeral arrangements. Fine. So the Gemara on Pehei Amud Aleph says the following. It's on the next page. I'm assuming everyone has Makara somewhere, even if it's not obvious. But I'm going to read through them. This one is more Kedai to see inside, the other ones are less so. So Mitzu Chaim Fakhin. So, okay, that thing are, the Mishnah said, well, if you find that he's alive, so then you save his life, right? Fine. And if you find out that he's dead, you don't. So, it's just an interest, just half a line here. It's important. Mitzoh chai pshita. Of course, mitzoh chai mfakin. Of course, pshita, what do you mean?
Where are you?
In the middle of the page on Pehei, after two dots. Mitzoh chai pshita. Right? Mitzoh chai mfakin. If you find that he's alive, you keep going. So, pshita. So, lo tzricha dafil chai sha. We even will mfakin lava tagal chai sha, even if he will not live a full life after that, even for just a short time, we do violate Shabbos on his behalf. Just an important thing to know. So, v'im neis yan yichluhu. So, if you go a little bit farther down from that, I apologize, it's not marked off. So, tanu rabbanan. It's in the middle of the Tosfos Lo Tzricha. It's parallel to the middle of the Tosfos Lo Tzricha. Tanu rabbanan. So it says, imeis, imcha, you have to know if he's alive or dead. If he's alive, you keep going. If he's dead, you stop. So how do you know if he's alive or dead? It's very important. So kol zman that you're mesupah, you keep going. Because if there's something that he's alive, we're still going to know. But we still need to know, tan rabbana ad heichanu bodek. So where do you check until? So Rashi informs us, ad heichanu bodek, im domila meis sheino meizi zevarav. If the person is lying there, he looks like a dead person, he's not moving. Right? Ad heichanu mfakecha, das emes. How much do you have to uncover to dig on Shabbos to find out if he's actually dead or not? Meaning, if the person is screaming at you and yelling and saying, please save me, I don't have a shiloh, right? That's not. I mean, the question is, you're only talking about someone who looks like he's dead. If he doesn't look like he's dead, I'm not mesupik at all, and therefore he's clearly going to be alive. So, Tanu Rabbanan ad heichanu bodek. So, ad chotmo, v'yesh omrim ad libo. So, either the nose or the heart, two yesh omrims. And it's important to note that Yerushalmi here has, instead of libo, says tiburo, which may or may not mean the stomach. You can see the Feinayim on the other side that says there's actually no difference between the two. Some people want to make a big deal of it. The difference between the Bava and Yerushalmi, the Feinayim says it's not true. Regardless, ad chot moviyesh omrim ad libo, the reason each Yerushalmi, I should have that back, is important because many of the Rishonim actually had the gears of the Yerushalmi in our Bava. But Rashi clearly didn't. So ad libo. So there's ad chot mo and ad libo. It seems to be you check until the nose or you check until the heart. I'm going to assume that when you're checking to the nose, you're trying to see if the person is breathing. If you're checking to the heart, you're trying to see if this person has a heartbeat. I think that's a fair assumption. The Gemara doesn't say, but I think that's what we're looking for. This is now, there is universal agreement among the Rishonim that we pass an ad chotmo. We pass an ad chotmo, you check until the nose. So the question is, well, what are we looking at? If we're looking at, for what are the criteria for death? What physiological parameter am I looking for to determine if the person is alive or dead? Is it breathing or is it heartbeat? There is universal agreement among the Rishonim. We hear Paskin ad chotmo. And if this Gemara is indeed referring to the criteria for death, it's very clear as day that it should be ad chotmo and breathing. And if a person is unable to breathe on their own, therefore they should be dead.
Is it the easiest place to figure out heartbeat from the heart? Are there not easier places?
So again, you're asking a different question. I said, and I think I was careful about it, that if what the Gemara is referring to with the Machlokas is about the criteria for death, what determines whether you're alive or dead is breathing or heartbeat, and that's what they're talking about, so then, clearly, this is we paskin ad chotmo. Now, Ike is asking a question, well, are you sure that we're talking about criteria? And I'm not. And if you continue going in the Gemara, I think the Gemara is clearly not. And or at least Rashi understands the Gemara to be clearly as not. So let's continue reading the Gemara. So there's a little bit of a caveat. So, if you find there are a lot of people, you find the top people are already dead, don't assume that the people on the bottom of the pile are dead too, keep checking. Masahaya, It happens. Things happen. Building collapses, collapse in weird ways. It could be the people on the bottom are alive. Keep digging. Fine. So assume that maybe these Rishonim, these Amoraim who hold Adchot Monad Libo, or like Hani Tanai, the Tanya Mechan of Vlad Notzar Meroso, Shememar Mime Imi Atagozi, Velmer Gozni Zerush Vashlichi, Abashalom Emiti Burum Shalach Sharashav Eila Feila. Okay. So maybe it's parallel to the machlokas about where a child is born from. Is a child born from his head or from his tiburo, his chest, his stomach, whatever? And therefore, the same way that he starts off with his head, he starts off with breathing, presumably. Or he starts off with the heartbeat, he starts off with his chest. So too, the end of life is parallel. Maybe it's the same machlokas. When a person's dead is also considered to be where a person is created from. Maybe the person is dead when that which is created first stops. Fine. So the Gemara says no. That might be true. By Yitzira, who says it's parallel, even Abashal will agree that breathing is koveya here. So it's very clear that we're looking for breathing. Kolosh Nishmas Ruachayim Ba'apav is talking about breathing. Nishmas Ruachayim Ba'apav. And it sounds like even Abashal, who disagrees by Yitzira, is going to be by Mode by Misa, that is the criteria. Now, the Gemara continues. It's 1, 2, 3, 4 lines from where it gets wide. Amar Rav Papa. Going back to the Machlokas Ad Libo and Ad Chodmo. Machlokas Mimata Lemala. Aval Mimala Lemata Kevin the Badakle Ad Chodmo Shuv Eino Tzarech Dechsev Kolosher Nishmas Ruach Chaim Ba'apa. So he says, whoa. Ad Libo Ad Chodmo depends what direction you're coming from. Right? What direction are you coming from? Are you uncovering his feet first? And then moving up, right? Because there's going to be a focus on Libo and Chotmo. So you're uncovering, one's going to say, you're checking out Libo. And one's going to say, no, continue from Libo and go all the way to Chotmo. Or you could be coming from the head. And coming from the head, you can say, Ad Chotmo or Ad Libo. It makes a difference which one comes first, depending on which direction you're coming in. So Rashi helps us explain this over here. Hachi Garcin, Amar Apap, Machlokas mi lamala lamala. Machlokas tahanach tanai. The maramar ad libo, maramar ad chotmo, because you have to remind us, because you have the caveat in between, that's what we're going back to, milmata limala, from the bottom to the top. Shemotza derech margalosov, you uncover it with chila, ubodek v'holech klape rosho. Right, you're checking until you're going from the feet and you're going up. The maramar, libo yeshlav chen yesh bochius, shenish moshot ofekesha, maramar ad chotmo, zim nein chius nikar belibo v'nikar bochotmo. Maybe in a Rashi aside for a minute, let's think about this for a moment. There's a machlaikas that says what? You're uncovering his feet, and you're going up, and you're going up, and you're going up. And Madar says, Ad Libo says, okay, check his heart. And presumably you're checking for a heartbeat. And he has no heartbeat. So he says he's dead. Good. Don't check Ad Chotmo. And Madar Ad Chotmo says what? He's not dead. He doesn't have a heartbeat. His heart's not beating. He's dead. Kule Alma Lo Pligi. You don't have a heartbeat, you're dead. So what are you doing? Is that what the... How could he possibly say Ad Chotmo? You can't live without a heartbeat. That's clear. He says, Ad Libo... So... The machlokas is you coming up from the bottom, and now there is no heartbeat. So, okay. So why are we continuing? Why is that a machlokas? Why does one person say ad chotmo? And I think the obvious answer, I think that's Rashi's getting at very clearly. He says, "Demar amar yet belibo yeshlav chinyesh bochius shenishmaso dofek hashav." His neshama beats there, knocks there, whatever it is, reflected in the heartbeat. Umar amar ad chotmo. Yeah. So what's pshat in chotmo? It doesn't make any sense. He has no heartbeat. Sometimes you can't see. Sometimes you can't tell if the chiyus is in libo, if the chiyus is in chotmo. What does that mean? That means that, well, you know, this person's under a pile of rubble. And how are you checking if they have a heartbeat exactly? You don't have a stethoscope. Stethoscopes were discovered in the 1500s. You don't have a stethoscope. What are you, putting an ear to his chest under a pile of rubble? And you didn't find a heartbeat. You're so sure he's dead. You're positive. Zimnin, you can't tell. Could be a barely fat guy. You can't tell. Sometimes you can't tell. Or it's beating very weakly because he's just was hit by a pile of rubble. Rashi's telling you, Zimnin deinu nikar. Sometimes you can't tell if he has a heartbeat or not, so you have to go see if he's breathing. If you don't see his heartbeat, if you can't tell he has a heartbeat, and he's not breathing, you can assume that what? You assume his heart's not beating. Well, you want to know if his heart beating or not, but sometimes I can't tell. Sometimes I can't tell if his heart is beating or not because it's hard. Zimnin deinu chiyus nikar. It makes a lot of sense. I can't tell. Sometimes I have to see if chiyus is nikar bichotmo. But what I'm really looking for in the Chacham Tzvi makes is very clear, is what I'm really looking for is, does he have a heartbeat or not? So according to Rashi, what's going on? It's not really a discussion of a criteria for death at all. We're not discussing what are the criteria, is a heartbeat versus breathing. What we're discussing is, what's the best test? I want to know, does this man have a heartbeat or not? So is it sufficient to check his chest? I'll feel it, I'll put my ear to it, maybe I'll use a stethoscope. Or no, I have to go see if the man damer, no. Even if you find nothing, you still have to go see if he's breathing, because maybe your test isn't accurate enough. It's a machlokas about testing. Now, in order not to make it a machlokas about mitzinus, we would say, well, what is the level of, what is the threshold of accuracy or sensitivity you need in order to allow you to proceed? Is the test sensitive or not, enough or not? So the machlokas is, well, what's the level of sensitivity necessary?
How much medical knowledge are you presuming they have?
Little. So, but going back to our assumption then, going back to what we said before, think about the difference between definitions, criteria, and tests. Rashi's pointing out that even if your havamina was, it's about criteria, it's not. Clearly based on Rav Papa's discussion, this is based on tests. The machlokas is about which test is more accurate, the criteria is heartbeat. Now, again, let's think about definitions, criteria, and tests again. Definitions are this broad conceptual idea. A criteria is a physiological parameter that represents that definition. The test is a metzias, yes or no. Does the man have a heartbeat or not? So that's a yes or no, that's not a halacha. That's not a din, that's a metzias. A test is certainly going to change. A test is, well, what's the mitzias? Use the best tools available to you today to find out if that mitzias is there or not. So the machlokas here in the Gemara is about the test. Now, that was the test that was available to them. But clearly the test is going to be available to us because it's based on the mitzias. The test is just telling me yes or no. Rashi's telling me the machlokas here is about a test. It's not halacha l'moshe misinai that this is the test you have to do. You're trying to find the mitzias. So if you're finding a mitzias, you have to use the best of the tools available. And we'll see, Rav Avadia has a point about this later, Rav Zalman, but we'll just see it inside in a moment. Yeah. Well, no, Rashi assumes that it's about heartbeat. Rashi goes, Zimnin dein chiyus nikar belibo ve nikar bechotmo. Why are you checking the breathing? Because I really want to know if he has a heartbeat.
Doesn't Rashi think that the heartbeat, when he says chiyus, like, knocking on, he just assumes that the heartbeat is a symbol for something else, not that it's...
Correct. The heartbeat is a symbol for something else, correct. But that a heartbeat is part of the criteria. I mean, it's symbolic for the neshama. So, yes, in the Hanami... So where does he get that from? I don't know. We'll see if I don't know. But where does Rashi get that from? It's not clear anymore. Correct. It's not clear.
Couldn't it also be either or? Right? Rashi said you can't tell about the heartbeat once you have
CBC. Or you need both. At least for Rashi, you need both. At the very least, you need both.
Oh, right. Exactly.
For Rashi, you would need both.
Right.
Correct. Right. At the very least, for Rashi, you would need both. But everyone who doesn't have a heartbeat isn't breathing either.
Do they know that?
Rashi's assuming that, yes. I think that's why he's wording it in this way, because they would know that.
If a person, they know it.
Well, they don't have to understand the physiology behind it. They could just based on empirical knowledge. Like,
I mean, you said that the only time with this question that we're being shy is because we have ventilators. So they're always going to have dealt with people who have...
Right, they've never encountered someone without a heartbeat who was breathing.
Nor somebody who was breathing without a heartbeat.
Nor someone who was breathing without... Because that can't exist. Correct.
They never encountered...
So Rashi is requiring both. I think that's clear. Rashi is requiring both. Rashi is requiring both. So, but the question I think you could ask is, oh, fine, so that explains Milamata Lamala. Right? You check on the bottom up. What about from the top down? The top down, everyone agrees you stop at the breathing. So, yeah. So why is that? So, the assumption is, and the Chacham Sfis make this clear, is that, yes, in Nachanami, when a person is unable to breathe, we assume that he doesn't have a heartbeat either. Why? He's domalames, he's not moving, and he's unable to breathe. Because Ikar Chiyus V'Apei, that is an accurate test for both things. That's an accurate test for also... for the heartbeat. Because Zimnin Dein Chiyus Nikar Libo V'Nikar Bechotmo. It only works in one direction. It's not Nikar Belibo, but it's also Nikar Bechotmo. It doesn't work the other way. Once a person's unable to breathe, and they're not breathing again irreversibly, however that was determined back in the day, I don't know. But I'm assuming they had some way of determining whether it was irreversible or not, probably just waiting there and looking. Then so too, we would assume that their heart has stopped. So if you look, the Chacham Tzvi makes this clear. The Chacham Tzvi is very famous in this brain death debate. Very rarely is the Chacham Tzvi analyzed in full. The Chacham Tzvi is talking about a silent traithus. And in order to understand the Chacham Tzvi, you have to understand he's writing to Rav David Oppenheim and Nishal David back and forth, like three or four tshuvas back and forth. You read the whole thing, it's fascinating. Whether or not, so the Chacham Tzvi makes, you can see the Chacham Tzvi here, actually. It's a Shaila Ayin Zayin. This is one of the points I don't recall offhand. If it's my book, it's clear. Which point is he here referring back to Rav David Oppenheim? Rav David Oppenheim was talking about a chicken that they found without a heart. They found the chicken without a heart. So the shaila was, is this animal a nevela or a trefa? Meaning, they said, this girl found the chicken and said it has no heart. So maybe it's a trefa, because animals should have hearts. And Chacham Tzvi is saying, no, the animal is perfectly kosher. It must have had a heart and she lost it. And the fact that she said she didn't lose it is irrelevant, because it's not possible. Can't live without a heart. The Chacham Tzvi is telling you that the heartbeat is very important for all sorts of things. So Rav David Oppenheim tried to prove Rashi the other way, and the Chacham Tzvi is he writes clearly, Harei Shehiskim Rashi Zal Advarim Shaneshama Mishkana Balev. The Chacham Tzvi in the first paragraph with the arrow in the middle of it. Harei Hiskim Rashi Zal Advarim, it's page 5 of the packet. Harei Hiskim Rashi Zal Advarim Shaneshama Mishkana Balev. El Dulafam Afshan Neshama Adain Tochalev. Ain Ad Fikos Nikaris Balevo. Sometimes you can't tell it's there. It's hidden. You can't see it. So this is where it gets a little bit fishy, right? He assumes that the breath is coming out of the heart and into the mouth, into the lungs. So the Chacham Tzvi has a very different view of physiology than we do. He assumes that the air goes into the heart, doesn't go into the heart. The physiology is irrelevant. Yet, his physiology we do not believe to be correct based on modern science, that the heart is involved with actually pumping air out. The air doesn't touch the heart at all. It would be pretty bad if it did. But so his physiology is off. But the way he's reading Rashi is clearly, I think, that it, the machlokas here is about testing and not about the criteria, and therefore, if you read the Gemara, I think according to Rashi, the machlokas is about criteria. According to Rashi, you need both to stop, at least, at the very least. It's, when I say heartbeat, it's both. You're not going to breathe at heart. And therefore, it's at the very least, you need both to stop, and therefore, so long as one of them is still functioning, a person would be considered to be alive. So based on this Gemara, based on the way of reading of Rashi, many poskim assume, therefore, that a brain-dead person is still alive, given that their heart is still functioning, and not only their heart. So not in every patient is this true. But on a large part, many of the other organ systems can still be functioning. Now, we don't always support the person to give them everything they need, and therefore that's not a raya. So brain death is usually a self-fulfilling prophecy, because often care will be withheld or not pursued aggressively or not, so we don't necessarily know that all those things are being pursued. When we're talking about pregnant women, for example, so more often than not, actually more often than not, this doesn't happen all that often, but people sometimes are more ready to give more care, because it's not just the woman who's we're worrying about, it's also about the baby. Even if we think that the woman is dead, the baby is not. And therefore, we're going to provide her with more care. And the longest a woman ever went in pregnancy brain dead is 107 days. But they were able to maintain her for 107 days after brain death, and then they delivered the baby early, but the baby was born healthy. With, you know, whatever issues for a preemie, but healthy for a preemie.
Could you just review in one or two sentences what you see from Shita's Rashi?
Sure. The machlokas in the Gemara could either be talking about criteria for death, meaning breathing versus heartbeat, and if so, then it's clearly breathing is the criteria for death, unanimously agreed by the Rishonim, it's ad chotmo, and if that's true, then a person who's unable to breathe on their own is dead, l'kulei alma, and a brain-dead person would be considered to be dead because they are not breathing. If, according to the way I understand Rashi, and many of the postmen understand Rashi, the machlokas in the Gemara is not about the criteria at all. The criteria is assumed that it's at least heartbeat or heartbeat and breathing. Everything has to stop. The machlokas is only about which test is more specific, more accurate, more reliable for Hilcha Shabbos. So if that's what the machlokas is about, so fine, tests are a matter of mitzias and therefore need to be updated with mitzias. And we can see we're not going to go through it, running out of time. Livia Schein Ravadia's halachas on Mishnah Berurah. I'm more tense to quote Ravadia, but you can look in Shmiras Shabbos. You can get in safer pretty much. Everyone will tell you, don't rely on any of these tests in the Gemara. Don't do this today. We have more accurate tests. We have better tests. Call an ambulance. I don't care if you think you're right. Unless you're a medical professional yourself, it doesn't really make a difference what you think. Call an ambulance, violate Shabbos. If someone there might be a chance that this person, first of all, is reversible. Secondly, that our tests are more accurate than theirs. And therefore, if that's true, the book is about testing, and that's about mitzvahs. But the criteria for death are all agreed upon that it would be heartbeat. The only question is, what's the most accurate way to reflect it? So today, yeah, I would put an EKG machine on the guy and find out if he has a heartbeat or not. I wouldn't have to stand there with a feather, with an ear, to see if he's breathing or not.
Assuming that the criteria is only heartbeat, so therefore...
If the criteria is only breathing... If the criteria is heartbeat, then the brain dead person whose heart is continuing to function as long as other organs is alive. Now the Rabbanu took
not be able to.
And I said the person is alive, and therefore, if you killed him, it would be a gramritzicha or whatever it would be. If he's a treifa, if he's not a treifa, whatever it would be prohibited from one of the isser hariga to take out his heart. It won't be specific what the isser necessarily is. Yeah.
But again, just to clarify, it's also possible that Rashi needs both. But therefore, when you don't have breathing, then you're dead.
No, you need to have not both. You mean both need to be missing.
I thought breathing was just the accurate test. So if somebody's not
of heartbeat.
Right, so if you're not breathing, so we assume you also don't have heartbeat.
Correct.
Right.
But if you do have a heartbeat...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Correct? Okay. No, that's okay. It's not simple. So the Chacham Tzvi just... You should just be aware of the Chacham Tzvi, then goes out to quote a Zohar to prove his point. The Chacham Tzvi, I don't think, is prone to quote Zohars all the time, but there's a really good Zohar he quotes, and just because Contemporary Halacha doesn't give them Zohar, so I thought we would quote it. It's actually a great question. So it's just great to go through it. On the next page, Amar Rabbi Abba, Itkarna Milo Chadet Shamna Bibutzina Kadisha. He heard it from Shimon Bar Yochai. The Shamna Mishmei Rabbi Eliezer. I know I'm reading it fast, but it's just the story. So Yom Achad Ata Lekame Chad Chokim Goy. So a Goy comes to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Amar Le Sava Sava. Klad Bayan Bayin Al Mitzvah Minach. I have three questions for you. Great, this is a great story. Chad Ata Namrin Dis Bani Lechu Beis Makdash Achrona. You say there'll be a third Beis Hamikdash. V'ha, no, there's only a Raya in the Gemara, there's only a Raya in the Pasuk, it says, the Pasuk in Chagai says, Gadol Yed Kavod HaBayit HaZeh Achron Min HaRishon. You see, there are only two. I have a Raya in the Torah, there will not be a third Beis HaMikdash. Okay? V'su, Da'atun Amrin, Da'atun Kraven L'malka Eloh Yasir Mikol Sharamin. That you're closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu than everybody else. Man Demitgrim L'malka, Yuchad Etadir. So whoever's close to the king should be happier. Below Tzara, below Tchilu, below Dchiku, v'ha'atun betzara, v'dochko v'yigona tater, yotim mikol bnei alma. You guys are the most nebuch of anybody around. So how could you claim you're the closest to the king? And where? Our life is great, you know? So how can you tell we're farther from the king? V'su, dotun lo achle, nevelu trefa, begin to tev and breen. You don't eat the velos of trefa, so you'll be healthier, and you guys are all nebuch, and it's sad, and everyone's sick all the time, and we're all geschmack. We eat whatever we want, and we're great, and therefore, what's pshat? So why does the world have to do with anything? Because he has a line here. So, what he answers him? No, so I skipped the line. So, Bekitzer, so he, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai looks at him and turns him into a pile of bones. Okay. So one of his Talmidim says, okay, Taka, he was a Mechutzah, so you killed him. So, not our issue right now. He says, but Taka, what's the answer to the Shailas? Well, he had good questions, what did he answer the questions? So the middle question is, Shail to Achra, Devadei Anan Kraven Lamalke Lo Yosir Mikol Sharamin. Vadehachiu, it's true. The Israel Avid Lon Kutcha Brichu Liba the Choalma. We're the heart of the world. Vehachi Inun Israel Ben Shair Amin Kiliba Ben Shaifin. We're like the heart among the other limbs. Kemada Shaifel O Yachli La Mekam Be Alma Filu Riga Chadab La Liba. Just like the body could not live for a moment without a heart. So Hachi Amin Kulun Lo Yachli La Mekam Be Alma Vlo Israel. The world wouldn't be able to exist without us. So you see that the heart is what's the most important organ to determine death or life. So that's one of the riots of the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi then says, look, I would never look for a riot from the Zohar and tell you, you see a riot from the Zohar if that was all I had. But since it stems with the Gemara, so then it's important to quote the Zohar to recognize that the Taras HaNistar and Taras HaNigla go together often. So then, Rav David Oppenheim, this is Geshmak, he quotes him a Medrash Mishle, V'achochma, the Pesach in Mishle says, V'achochma ma'in timotze ve'ezim ekom bina. Right? V'achochma ma'in timotze. And there's a machlokas there, whether the Chochma is Barosh or Balev. So he says, you see, but there we seem to go by road. So the Chacham Tzvi points out, that's again with El Bar Ilan, yeah, but that's the opinion of Rabbi Elazar. And here we're talking about the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, and therefore there's no problem there. There are two different opinions, and he says there could be a machlokas in theory, but there's no problem in the halacha. The Zohar is just following the opinion of Rabbi Shimon. We don't follow the opinion of Rabbi Elazar. And that Medrash Mishle, if you look farther back, is actually quoting Rabbi Elazar, and therefore it's not an issue. So that's just a fun Chacham Tzvi. So, and just an opportunity to quote a Zohar, Kedabri Halacha. So, further building on this Rashi, so the problem is the Rishonim don't really talk about this Gemara. They just quote the Gemara as is. Adchot Mo'ad Libo, that's it. So, do they mean Adchot Mo'ad Libo as criteria? Or do they mean Adchot Mo'ad Libo as, like Rashi is saying, as test? You don't really know. It's just quoting the Gemara. Rambam just quotes the Gemara, Shalom just quotes it. So, what does that mean? They don't add Rashi's caveat. So, does that mean they disagree with Rashi? Or they assume Rashi is so obvious that it wasn't need to be quoted? I have no idea. But if you look in the Shut Ma'arsham, this is Chelek Vav, Simon Kuf Dalid, you don't have to read inside. So he had a following Shaila from the Chevar Kadisha. It was Erev Shabbos, and they were rushing, and it didn't work out, and they needed to get in before Shabbos, and they're doing the Tara, and they heard a noise from the body. And they didn't know what to do, and they continued doing the Tara, and they buried the guy. So do they need Kapara or not? Because really, think about it, back in the day, who determined death? It was the Chevar Kadisha. Wasn't doctors. The Chevar Kadisha came and said this person's dead. The Chevar Kadisha would come and sit there at the last moments and say, Shema Yisrael, there's a whole bunch of tefillahs to say at the end of life. Satmar actually publishes a little booklet, it's in every hospital. You look in the Ma'avar Yabok, where it all comes from, it's a school for a long life, if you manage to say all of those things at the last moment. There's like pages, like 50 pages of things that you're supposed to say at the very last moment. It seems like a school that'll keep the guy going. It's a lot. Satmar has it condensed down. So the Chevar Kadisha would be the ones who would determine whether the person's dead or not. How do you know? You call the Chevar Kadisha. So they said he's not breathing anymore, he's dead. So the Ma'arsham is clear. He says, so the guy said, well, there was a noise that came from the guy, but look, we checked if he was breathing. He wasn't breathing, so he must be dead, al pidin. And if he was any noise after that is irrelevant. So if you look at the bracketed section, He says, "Avam lekol makom tzatku dvarav devadei kaimel and tikar chiyusa be'ape kaven to be malal lemata in tzarich livdok rakat chol no according to Gemara." Aval haynu b'stama im leika hochacha lehipuch samchina b'tikar chol no. That's correct. You check if he's not breathing, and you could therefore assume that he has no heartbeat when there's no raya lehepach. To have a rov gomer v'afilu miuta leika. We can assume that that's true. He says, but if there's a simon that the guy is still alive, then you can't rely on the breathing. Breathing is a simon that something else has stopped. And therefore, if he's having another noise coming out of this guy's body, now, is that real? Is that gases or not? You have to determine. Fine. But if that's a problem, so you can't just rely on the fact that he's not breathing. Breathing is just a simon that everything else has stopped. So if the guy's heart was still beating, the shayla would not be in front of the Maharsham. Like, Taka, he stopped breathing, but his heart was still beating, but we did continue to do the Tara anyway. We were talking about just the noise. He's very clear that the breathing is just a simon for other things, and therefore when the person's not breathing, we can assume nothing else is working. But if you see the favorites, you see the monitor bleeping on the wall, that his heart is still beating, then he's telling you, the favorites, that that is not a valid criteria. You have not met the valid criteria for death. The next most important tshuva on this matter is the tshuva of the Chasam Sofer. It's in Yordaya, Simon Shin Lamed Ches. This tshuva is quoted by everybody who talks about brain death, whatever position they take, and they say, ukid the Isa of the Chasam Sofer. And some of them actually quote it, some of them don't. The Chasam Sofer can be used to pull in either direction, and I'll tell you the truth. When I wrote my book, this was the first chapter I wrote. I really just wanted to write an article about the Chasam Sofer, and then it just morphed from there. That was the first thing I wrote about. Because I think this is a fascinating tshuva. So this is actually a tshuva which actually deals with the issue. This tshuva is actually written to the Maritz Chiz. It doesn't actually say who it's written to. If you look, his name is not there. Rav Shapter likes to point out, because he makes fun of the guy for having a bad svara, but the Maritz Chiz was proud of the fact that he had a tshuva from the Chasam Sofer, so he published it in his own sefer. In Kol Sefer Maritz Chiz, you see this tshuva from the Chasam Sofer, and he wrote it to me. He wrote back. Chasam Sofer did not respond. But we know it's the Maritz Chiz. The question was as follows. They made a gzeira in Germany that there's a problem of premature burial. And I was at this conference yesterday, and Dr. Theo Dagi from Harvard was pointing out this actually goes back even farther. We have papyruses about what we'll do. But in Germany, this was came to the fore of a big issue, that people were being buried prematurely, meaning they were still alive. And that's not good. So they made a rule that you have to wait for burial 72 hours after you presume a person to be dead, just in case you're wrong. There's a whole literature about premature burial. They used to install bells in coffins and telephone systems in coffins. I found some pamphlet written, the problems of the Jewish perspective, particular problems with the Jewish approach to premature burial, because we're so mocked to do it so quickly, so we have the biggest problems ever. They have a whole problem with the Jewish approach, and they would install bells, and saved by the bell, that very phrase comes from this. That person was saved by the bell, had a bell installed in the coffin, supposedly, for light systems. That they had a bell installed in the coffin to save your life. That if you're alive, you'll ring the bell and someone will come and get you because it's not a problem. So they said, but it's chesh b'goch nefesh. It's chesh b'goch nefesh. It makes a lot of sense. So cover tik berenu lo salu nivla, so all that's correct. But mitzad sheni b'goch nefesh is doch hakol. So should we follow this or not? Should we wait 3 days or not? So that's not actually the question the Chasam Sofer was asked. The Chasam Sofer was asked the following question. You need to get someone to certify when the person dies, fine. Then they made a rule, you have to have a doctor certify that the person died. After he died, a doctor has to come in and certify it. That was the rule that was made. Now, you never had to do that. Until then, it was the Chavar Kadisha who did it. So there was a doctor who was a Kohen. Can he come in and certify that the guy was dead? That's the Shaila. So, although I only printed for you the first page of the Chasam Sofer, there's another two columns, which all deal with Tumas Kohanim, which is fascinating. Tumas Goyim Ba'oel, and he speaks about Nassan Adler and the Gol Mervava. They met on the bridge in Prague. It makes it into the Gol Mervava on the Shulchan Aruch, on the side there. It's fascinating. At the very, very end, was the Shaila. You should just know at the end, the Chasam Sofer writes at the end of the letter, don't tell the Kohen this, but of course it's Mutter, because he's a Meis Mitzvah. Even though I think the guy was dead already, and therefore the doctor is not saving his life, it's not Pekoch Nefesh at all, we can't bury him until he comes in. So it's a Meis Mitzvah. So if there's no other doctor around, we're going to let him be violate Tumas Kohanim for the Meis Mitzvah. But that's irrelevant. The Chasam Sofer argues, no, the person is dead when we have the classic criteria that are met in Halacha. We do not care that there are other issues. We can assume that our criteria are accurate, our tests are accurate, and the fact that there could be there exceptions to them is a miut of achas me'elef or something like that, some phrase which means very, very little. I don't know how much to... Some poskim want to... Achas me'elef, it has to be 1 in 1,000. Less than 1 in 1,000, more than 999 would not be. I don't know, it just seems to be a very, very something we're not concerned with. And he seems to go through, and he goes through the whole Gemara, he goes through Rambam, Marin of Vuchim, at the very, where the line, where the arrow is, he seems to summarize the whole perspective. So now, at first he seems to be talking about breathing. So those who want to advocate breathing say, you see, the Chassid Sofer only spoke about breathing, only spoke about breathing, only spoke about breathing. And then those who want to argue the opposite quote this one line. The line that has the arrow. What does that mean? He has to be not moving, right? Because if the guy's talking to you, there's no shaila, right? Rashi was clear. The guy's not talking to me, right? That's what the Maharsham is pointing out. He has no pulse. No heartbeat, no pulse. Then he's not breathing, then he's dead. So he says, he seems to indicate that he has no heartbeat. Now, everyone agrees that he's dead. That's correct. Is this the everyone agrees that he's dead, or is that the minimum criteria for death? So you'll get this quoted in different places by different people. Those who want to say heartbeat will focus on this line of the Chasam Sofer. Those who want to focus on breathing will focus on the earlier lines of the Chasam Sofer. And they have a very hard, I think, it's opinion again, not saying anyone's wrong, but this line is hard to read if you want to focus on breathing. He does say Himbo Shum Defika. And so it's a little bit difficult. So we're going to skip a little bit. The next page is from the Rabbanut, actually the Rabbanut letter that they wrote in Kavkim Adar Tavshim Mem Zayin about, this is the letter they sent out, and this was the background for it. We're going to skip it right now, if that's okay. They do go with breathing as the criteria for death, and they have to read through Rashi and read through the Chasam Sofer by focusing on the first part of the Chasam Sofer. They actually, it's fascinating, now we're talking about, was it heartbeat or breathing? They assumed it was so pushed it was breathing. The only shaila is this guy breathing or not? He's on the ventilator. Is that breathing or not? Every kuli amal pligid, it's breathing. Breathing is a termination of life and death. Is this guy breathing or not? He's on the ventilator. So is that shmei neshima or lav shmei neshima? And they try to prove it's not, it's not, it's not, it's not, it's not. Okay, it could be or could not be. What's breathing? Is breathing the work of breathing, meaning breathing in? Or is breathing the outcome of breathing? Right? I believe in one place in the Sefer suggests this. I don't know if he adopts it. He suggests this might be true, that the point of breathing is to get oxygen into your system, into your blood. Maybe breathing is the effect of breathing, not necessarily the work of breathing, although it seems like it's the work of breathing. They argue that it's the work of breathing, and therefore, this person is not breathing on his own. The fact that air is going in is irrelevant. He's not breathing, and therefore he should be dead. They take it as a basic assumption that it's breathing and just have to prove that this is not considered to be breathing. Fine. The next mukkar that's important to see is a Mishnah in Olives. Okay, we have time. Okay. So, we won't go through all the details, but this next Mishnah is important. So as again, as Dr. Steinberg pointed out, we don't have normal cases of death. We have Mishnah Naflalav Mapolas, and then we have this case. It's a little bit gruesome. Adam Eino Matame Asher Teitzei Nafsho. A person doesn't cause Tumas Meis until his Nefesh leaves. Okay, not so helpful. Vafilu Maguid, Vafilu Goseis, whatever those mean, it means he's dying, not dead. We're going to assume you could either be alive or dead. A dying person is alive. They're just on the way out. They're not dead yet, they're still alive. So Zokik Alibum Potter and Ibu Machil Bitrumo, Postum and Truma, you can look at the Farsum for exactly how that works. They are considered to be alive Likule Alma for both Ibum and Truma and everything else. The Chain Behema Vachaya Imitami Nachatesi Nafsham, so too with an animal is not Mitami Tumas Nevela until they die. Okay, Achatesi Nafsham. Fine, not helpful again. Hutzu Rashehem, their heads were severed. Cut off, decapitated. Are we talking about the animals? We're talking about the people. We're going to assume we're talking about everybody in the Mishnah, both people and animals. Af al Pisha Mefarkasin. Even though they are experiencing pirkus, which means bodily movements, tmeim, they are nonetheless tamei, kigons and azanav shal alatashim mefarkesis, just like the tail of a lizard that gets cut off. Now the point of quoting that is to tell us that, you know, we're not necessarily familiar with what decapitation looks like, hopefully not. We may be or may not be more familiar with chopping off lizards' tails. I'm going to go with the Mishnah's assumption that when you chop off a lizard's tail, it still wiggles a little bit. Chicken keeps running. Here, talking about the tail. We have a lot of salamanders and doka. Not tempted to do this ever, but every time I see one, I think about this Mishnah. Again, not cutting it off, not going to do that, but I think about I'm going to trust the Mishnah on this. So the body keeps moving after the head is removed. Fine. So, let me make sure I didn't miss anything. Okay, so the question is, fine, how do we understand this definition of death in light of the two options we had before? Is it breathing is the criteria for death, or heartbeat is the criteria for death? So if it's breathing, so then a person whose head is missing is no longer able to breathe. Makes sense. Their head's missing, they're no longer able to breathe on their own. Fine. Avalvisha Mepharkasin, even though they're still meaning Mepharkas, I don't know why the Mishnah didn't tell me that, but it doesn't make a difference. They are no longer able to breathe on their own, and it makes a lot of sense. And this is part of the Rabbanut's proof that you see it's about breathing. That's why this Mishnah makes a lot of sense. They're not able to breathe on their own. When the head's missing, that's just one way of not being able to breathe on their own. But if you hold heartbeat, so this is talk a little bit difficult, and this is a little bit gruesome, so if you get gruesome doubt, so then just close your ears or something. After a person's head gets chopped off by guillotine, so there was someone who studied this in the French Revolution, their body still moves a little bit and their heart continues to beat for a little while. Their heart continues to beat for a little while. Their head's missing, it's been chopped off. Their heart continues to beat. But the Mishnah says metamin. So you could argue, yes, they're alive, but they're still metamin. You can make such an argument. It's unlikely. I don't really have a good raya for it, but the assumption is that's a teitzei nafsho, a person isn't in the time at all, and therefore a teitzei nafsho, the assumption is he's dead. I think that's a fair assumption. So you see that the person has a heartbeat, but he's still dead. So isn't this a raya against the heartbeat part? The whole tzad that has a heartbeat, this person's heart's beating, even for a couple of moments. So in the chanami, he'll be in the time at all, but there's nothing we can do about it. He'll be in the time at all in the chanami. But just not yet. Wait till his heart stops. His heart's beating. Wait till his body stops moving. Obviously, mefarkasin, the Gemara is aware, the Mishnah is aware that mefarkasin, the body is still moving. And then also says metamin right now. So even though the heart's beating, also it's metamin right now. So what could possibly be pshat? Why is it, why should that be so? And who b'chlal told Rashi, where did Rashi get this whole idea of the heart from anyway? Right? That was the question he asked. Where did Rashi get this whole idea of the heart from? We don't see it anywhere. It's not in this Mishnah. It's not in any. Why is that the important criteria? So Rabbi Bleich and others, I believe, take the following approach. Now, I believe that others take the following approach because they take all sorts of other statements, and they get a mitzvah of the Yashiv Divrei Chachamim, and therefore putting them all together gives you the following suggestion. Rabbi Bleich makes this explicit, and I think the Rav Buzner, for example, or Sternbach would all sign on to this approach. It's not really about the heart. The heart isn't important because it's the heart. It's not a privileged organ, Rabbi Bleich's language. Meaning, if someone, let's say, we have a plastic heart. We discover when it works. We do a cardiac transplant with a plastic heart. So is this person alive or dead? So I'm going to assume he's alive because he's talking to me. Aye, but he doesn't have a heartbeat. So if you tell me, no. The whole cell doesn't get off the ground until he looks Gutel Kevin Domim and he doesn't have a heartbeat. So then you're telling me it's not just about heartbeat, it's about heartbeat plus. Heartbeat plus Gutel Kevin Domim, which means what? I don't know yet. But Gutel Kevin Domim plus a heartbeat, it's clearly not about heartbeat. We have people who are who can be on an artificial heart, for example, if such a thing were possible. It doesn't work for very long. We assume they're very much alive so long as other things are functioning about them. So it can't be necessarily about the heart. Rabbi Bleich points out it's not about the heart because you see from this Mishnah it's not about the heart because the heart can continue beating. So then what is it about? He says it's about vital motion. Vital motion is the ability of the body to function in a certain way, in a movement, something that's perceptible to the eye. Right, because we're only going to care in halacha, not necessarily about the chemistry, but there's something perceptible to the eye that maintains the continued viability of the organism. Now, normally, what is the most vital of all organs? You might argue is the heart. The heart is a vital organ. The lungs are vital organs. As long as they are functioning, the person is alive. So now, okay, other organs can be vital as well. Now, this person with a plastic heart, so why is he alive? Artificial heart. His vital organ isn't functioning. Well, his other vital organs that function. It's not the heart per se that's important. It's vital motion. As long as he has vital motion, which might be evidenced by he's responding to you, he's talking to you, that's showing vital motion. The fact that he has a plastic heart is irrelevant. It's not the heart per se. The heart is just one example of vital motion. It's a very good example of vital motion. It's an example of vital motion. And therefore, just having a heartbeat alone, just one moment, is not necessarily going to be enough. It has to be vital motion. So Rashi in Yuma is telling you what? Any vital motion would count. That's effectively what the Maharsham is telling you also in Rashi, right? Any vital motion is going to count. This person's mutal kevin domim, he's not moving. Venera kamesh, ain't no mazik zevarav, right? Otherwise, there's no shaila. I wouldn't have to worry whether he's dead or alive if he's talking to me. He looks dead. The only simin chias I could find is, does he have a heartbeat? That's the only thing left. So if he does, that's a simin of vital motion. The heartbeat is an example of vital motion, b'chai gavna. But if you had another example of vital motion, and the chinami would be true, that person would be alive. It just, under a building collapse, that's going to be the last thing to go. So the last thing to go, as long as he has some kind of vital motion, that's the last thing to go. Therefore, Rashi says heart was an example of vital motion. What about this Mishnah? So this Mishnah, his heart's still beating. It's vital motion. So why is he metame ba'ol? So again, it's not about heartbeat per se, it's about vital motion. What does vital motion mean? Maintaining continued viability, the biological viability of the organism. What's happening, again, getting very gruesome, when this person's head is chopped off and his heart continues to beat? Blood is spurting out everywhere. His heart is pumping the blood out of his body through this gaping wound in his neck. His heart is exsanguinating him, effectively, right? His heart is pumping all the blood out of his body. That's not vital motion. Vital motion requires a circuit. That's why it's called circulation. The heart, per se, the beating of the muscle of the heart doesn't do anything if it's not providing a vital function. The vital function means circulation. So in theory, if you would take this person and connect all of the tubes, right? So that the heart, the blood, you would, you're not the captain, the person of the guillotine, clearly. You would do it in a much, much, much more, why you would do such a thing is a different question, it's probably also. But let's say someone did, and connected all the pipes in the right way, so that blood would not be spurting out, and we would maintain circulation, such a person, in economy, is experiencing vital motion, and would be alive according to this definition. Therefore, again, according to this approach, a brain dead person is considered to be alive because they are experiencing continued vital motion, evinced by their heart, by the fact that a baby is growing within them, the liver is functioning, intestines are functioning, other things are functioning as well. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a middle approach to this Mishnah. He says there are two definitions of death. There are two possible ways to be dead. He says it's either the irreversible cessation of vital motion, in most cases the irreversible cessation of vital motion, or missing your head. He doesn't accept the part about the circulation. If you're missing your head, you're decapitated. That is a separate definition of death. You could have two ways to determine death in halacha. So, is that a fundamental problem? It's not necessarily elegant, but is it a fundamental problem? I don't think so. If you, again, you assume that death is, the definition of death is the yetzias neshama, is some theoretical, is it not theoretical, it's a philosophical concept, so then mehechi tesi can only be gotten at through one way. Maybe the neshama can leave more than one way. Maybe I can have proof that the neshama left in more than one way. Mehechi tesi should only be one way, so fundamentally there's no problem with having two definitions of death, but it's not terribly elegant, but so on. And you have to know which one you're working with. So Shlomo Zalman then had another chiddush. Shlomo Zalman's chiddush said, if every single cell of your brain is dead, a person is dead. Now, if you look here in the Mishnah's Chayisha, Rav Simcha Bunim Lazerson, his nephew, I believe, he wrote the Shulchan Shlomo's. He points out it's about the brain. It's not about the head per se. It's clear Shlomo Zalman thought that Hutzir Roshem is talking about the brain. Another chiddush of Shlomo Zalman. It's talking about the brain. And then he said, well, if every single cell of the brain is dead, then it's as if the head is missing, which is another chiddush of Shlomo Zalman, because the head is still there. He's saying, well, if it's not, if every single cell of the brain is dead, therefore it's as if it is missing. So what does dead mean? How do you know if cells are dead or alive? Do you ask your doctor or not? I don't know. Presumably he meant, when we talk about death of limbs in halacha, which we need in Basar Sharofa Goro, that the, we're just running out of time, so I just want to finish with Shlomo Zalman. I'm happy to take as many questions as you want after. I'm here until actually all afternoon, so it's very exciting. Either Basar Sharofa Goro, that a doctor would remove if it was infected, or Basar Shenifrach Betziporin, that moves when you touch it, that is considered to be cell death. That is not true in brain death. In almost all brain death cases, this was in 1964, when they made, or 1965, when they made the original criteria, they required that the brain be liquefied. That doesn't happen in brain death. There are studies of anatomical dissections of brains after death. They are certainly not liquefied. And not even using standard cell assays can you say that all the cells are necessarily dead. And so, therefore, Rav Shlomo Zalman's criteria certainly are not met. And therefore, in a chanami, such a thing could exist, but lemaisa, it doesn't. So Rav Shlomo Zalman would adopt two separate approaches. Do we have four more minutes or not? Or would we take questions? Or probably take questions and we'll leave Rav Shlomo Zalman's proof out of it. Your call. Leave it. Okay, so let's. So again, there are three approaches. There's irreversible cessation of spontaneous respiration, meaning irreversible cessation of spontaneous respiration. All those words are important. It's irreversible, again, cessation of spontaneous respiration, breathing on your own. Irreversible cessation of vital motion, again, which is a broader, vaguer concept. It's harder to know, well, what is vital motion? I can ask you all sorts of very, very difficult questions. Is that vital motion or not vital motion? And they're all very, very good questions. It doesn't mean that the definition is incorrect. It just means that practically it has to be more refined. The fact that something can't be practically applied doesn't make it any less correct than a more accurate definition. I can give you a definition of death when a person's temperature reaches 96.3 degrees, they're dead. Now, that's just silly, but it's very accurate. That doesn't make it any more correct, the fact that it's more precise. Precision doesn't necessarily indicate correctness or accuracy in this regard. So the fact that it's less precise doesn't make it any more incorrect. It just means that it needs to be sharpened, because as technologies advance, we're hitting on more and more difficult questions that need to be figured out for that approach. According to Rav Shlomo Zalman, he adopts a dual approach, either irreversible cessation of vital motion or decapitation, removing and missing the head, which he has a further chiddush, means that every single cell of the brain is dead, whatever that means, and that does not seem to be likely under the current circumstances.
Just mention if 10 layers, depending on what the question might be on that.
So Rabbi Tendler in two different places. Last time we did Rabbi Tendler, I wanted to do something, it didn't work out. Rabbi Tendler in different places assumes two different things. I've asked him about it, but he tries to put them together. At one point he assumes that it's all about breathing. He assumes it's irreversible cessation of spontaneous respiration.
Which means that brain
is death. He always assumes brain death is death. The question is, how do you get about it? Is it that the person is no longer able to breathe on their own? I'm sorry, I'm talking so quickly, I just want to make sure we finish by time. That a person is no longer able to breathe on their own, therefore they're dead. And in another place, he coins a phrase called physiological decapitation. It's as if, kutzu rasheihem, when the brain is no longer functioning, therefore it's as if the brain is no longer passing on messages to the body, therefore it's physiological decapitation. It's as if the brain is no longer there, and therefore it should be the same din as kutzu rasheihem. In one place, he seems to indicate this has to do with something called somatic integration. What makes us a human organism and not just a collection of organ systems? What makes me not just a circulatory system and an endocrine system and an intestinal system and all those things is that somatic means bodily integration. They're all brought together. That, and what brings my body together, it presumably is the brain, and the brain creates somatic integration, and once you cease to have somatic integration, then you are dead. The problem is the President's Council on Bioethics in 2008 already pointed this out, who are strong advocates for brain death, even when they had to admit that their previous definition was not up to par. Coincidentally, they came out having the same status quo. The assumption is that, first of all, brain dead patients can maintain somatic integration, and secondly, somatic integration is not necessarily found in the brain. So if you think that somatic integration is the be-all and end-all, and that's what death is defined as, so then brain dead patients may still maintain somatic integration for a variety of different reasons, and therefore that wouldn't be correct. In another place, he wants to argue that it's non-functional. It's a more complicated position, but that's why I present as three broad approaches, and Rabbi Tendler's approach can fit either in one of them or in between one of them on that spectrum. Yeah.
Does Rav Shlomo Zalman assume that when you chop off somebody's head, then all the cells in the brain are dead?
They're missing. No. Missing. Meaning once they're missing, it's fine. And when they're dead, it has a din of missing. Right? Black doesn't like that. But that's, it has to be missing. So he says this is the equivalent of being missing, but not necessarily that they're dead, because they're not.
Right.
They're not. Yeah. Oh, okay. So Rav Shlomo Zalman had this whole fascinating discussion whether... I'll go with it. Okay. Well, it's up to you if you want. I don't know who has to go. We have 9 more minutes or no? We have to run?
The idea of the breathing being spontaneous and stuff, so is there room to say that even if a person doesn't do anything about the breathing, but myosin is sort of... breathing is happening.
Is it happening from his body or from outside? That's the question. Spontaneous means is it happening inherently or not? So I'll go very, very, very quickly. Rav Shlomo Zalman assumed that this was true, right? That at some point, if every cell, that he envisioned the possibility that a brain dead person could be dead, because maybe the cells of the brain aren't working. He then came up with a raya from a Gemara in Erechin against himself. So the Gemara in Erechin, we're not going to go through it, says the following. The Gemara in Erechin assumes that a pregnant woman cannot die before her fetus, right? A pregnant woman cannot die before her fetus. That is the assumption of the Gemara. The Gemara is mechalik between Neherga and Mesa Kedarka, and Rav Shlomo Zalman gets around it. It's an interesting chiddush how he gets around it. Rav Shlomo Zalman reads the Gemara in Erechin at least as saying the following, that a pregnant woman cannot die before her fetus. Whether that's an accurate reading of the Gemara or not, that's how Rav Shlomo Zalman read that Gemara. Therefore, he said the following, how can a pregnant brain-dead mother give birth to a living baby? Right? If a pregnant woman cannot die before her fetus, and the fetus is alive, it must mean that the mother is alive as well. Okay? Is that clear? That makes sense? Blank stares, yeah.
Well, maybe he thinks that person isn't... Like, there's two definitions of death, so she might not have any of the...
No, he reasons where it's not possible for the pregnant woman to die before her fetus.
Right.
Certainly not over an extended period.
Right.
It could happen suddenly. Like, if her head... meaning, they're not killed suddenly. He differentiates between if it's sudden, meaning then, yes, she's shot, so she could die before her fetus dies. He's talking about a long term. You could not maintain the pregnant woman alive with... you cannot have a dead woman give birth to a fetus after an extended period. And therefore, if any woman gives birth to a fetus, we can assume that mother is alive. We must assume the mother is alive based on this Gemara. And therefore, a brain-dead woman who gives birth to a fetus, again, not in that moment, but is maintained for any significant period of time, even a matter of hours... can be days, can be many days, then it must mean she's alive. I have a raya from a Gemara in Erechin against brain death, because it must mean these women are alive.
Doesn't the Chazal say that incubator counts as continuing pregnancy, so it's not like the words of, it's not the pregnancy itself, but it's the maintenance of a certain...
Fascinating question, not for him.
Isn't that wrong?
It's not relevant. I disagree that it's relevant, but I don't want to... I'm happy to discuss it, just let's get to the point. They did the following most amazing experiment ever. I don't have the video of it. They took a pregnant sheep, and they said, according to you, Rav Shlomo Zalman, you have two definitions of death. it is either irreversible cessation of vital motion or decapitation. What if I decapitate this sheep and then an hour later deliver a living baby? What would you say then? Because you would have to agree that this sheep is dead. It's decapitated. The sheep is decapitated. Decapitation is dead. And then I can deliver a living baby afterwards. Again, with a sheep, not a person. Therefore, what does that do? So they did the experiment. And this is a bunch of rabbanim got together with veterinarians. It's an amazing thing. Like, this is Torah Umana. This is like, it's prime. This is like Gishmak. Like, there were rabbanim in the room and dying veterinarians and like, yeah. Dr. Abraham told me, Dr. Steinberg was there. There's a whole Gishmak thing. And they did it. And the baby died before it was born. They decapitated the sheep, and the baby died in utero. All of a sudden, the heart stopped, and the baby died. So they said, but you see, even after the decapitation, the baby's heartbeat, the sheep, again, not baby, the baby sheep, heart continued to beat. So you see that if it continued to beat, it's still alive after the mother. They said, yeah, but that's not a riot, because how do you know that the baby was really alive? Because the heartbeat was still beating. The mother's heartbeat was still beating, and telling me the mother's dead. So you can't tell me the heartbeat alone is a simchias. Because the mother's heartbeat was beating, the mother sheep, again, being very clear, the mother sheep heart was beating, I saw it on the machine, and the baby's heart was beating, I saw it on the machine. If one's not alive, the other's not. So they did it again. They did the experiment a couple weeks later again. Instead of decapitating the sheep, now they just took out the brain, whatever. They waited an hour, they waited, like, I think, only a half hour this time, they delivered the baby, and the baby lived. Or until it was eaten. So they went to Rav Shlomo Zalman, and they said, you see, a dead animal can deliver a living baby. What do you do with this Gemara? So you see that the raya again, meaning it's not a raya for anything. It just, he had a raya against brain death. Now this raya is being mafresh the raya against. Doesn't prove anything for, but it's being mafresh the raya against. But see what extent people went through to, if some of them had a raya, and this is what they did to disprove the raya. So he said, first of all, this is not a person. This is a sheep. Okay, that's obvious. Dr. Abraham points out in conversations, he pointed out also, look, these women are being maintained for 107 days, not a half hour. And a chanami for a half hour, maybe reading the Gemara wouldn't apply. Secondly, Rosh Hashanah says, okay, maybe that's not true. Maybe the Gemara meant that the normal circumstances, how did you maintain the sheep? Just think about it. Then they cut off the head. They had to connect all the tubes again. They had to provide a breathing tube down the hole in the neck, right? They had to provide oxygen to the lungs. It's effectively putting the sheep in the ICU. So in the Hanami, if you put the mother in the ICU, she could die, and you have a pregnant woman who could, in theory, be dead and deliver a living baby. He thought that in the Hanami, that could be true. It could be true. In the Gemara, it wasn't possible. Today, it is possible. That Gemara in Erechin is not telling you a fundamental truth in Halacha. It's telling you a fact in Mitzias, and therefore today, Mitzias, it could be true. Now, it doesn't necessarily prove anything about brain death. It just proves that brain death, at least, could be death. It doesn't, Rishon's always had a raya against it. It just takes away the raya against it, but nonetheless, Rav Shlomo Zalman was hesitant. At the end of his life, he was told that the hypothalamus is still functioning, part of the brain that controls body temperature and blood pressure and all sorts of other things, may still be functioning in a brain-dead person. And therefore, he wrote Beferish, that everything I wrote until now is as if I didn't write it. If the brain, if part of the brain is still functioning, then the whole thing falls. He had all these cheshbonos that maybe it's just something ghostly, something mace, and therefore you could turn off a ventilator. There's a famous line from Rav Shlomo Zalman, if you look in this Masaf Ram, he writes, you can turn off a ventilator on a brain-dead patient. You have to look carefully that is when he assumed that the entire brain was dead. When he then, sequentially, just follow the chronology, these are letters, they're dated. I spoke to Dr. Abraham about this. Dr. Abraham, the author of this Masaf Ram, we spoke to him daily about this. That when he learned that parts of the brain could still be alive, then the whole thing fell. If parts of the brain could still be alive, then even Rav Shlomo Zalman thought that even the ventilator can't be removed. Forget organ donation, which he was supposed to. He thought just removing a ventilator, just in terms of caring for our dying patients, maybe that would be necessary. But in the end of the day, Rav Shlomo Zalman did not allow it because he assumed that because parts of the brain could still be alive. But that is the point of the sheep experiment. Famous.
Would everyone assume that?
If there is no vital motion, no, I mean, the hypothalamus does real things in the body. No, there is vital motion. Rav Shlomo Zalman, again, the only person who could conceive of such an idea is Rav Shlomo Zalman. Because he can say, even though there's vital motion, if the brain is missing, you're still dead. Right? Everybody else who holds vital motion will tell you, no, there's still vital motion, you're alive. Only Rav Shlomo Zalman can tell you that that's true. But if part of the brain is still functioning, so you haven't met either criteria. There's still vital motion, and the brain is still functioning. So you're out of luck.
So then,
not always. It can be true. I mean, it can be...
Easily
is a...
Meaning you can ask.
Yes and no. Not as positive as I'm making it in the last 30 seconds. Now. Yeah. But if it's true, then Rav Shlomo Zalman would agree that you haven't met the vital motion criteria, and you haven't met the brain missing criteria, so in the person's alive, and therefore the ventilator cannot be removed, and organs cannot be removed either. Okay. I'd cut.